Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 5th, 2008, and this is show number 172. Well, do you ever have one of those days where just everything seems to go wrong? You know, it's not a bad day. Like, nobody gets hurt. Nobody ends up in the hospital. You know, you didn't have all your investments in a failed bank. It's just one of those days. My friend Diane calls it a three pantyhose day, where you tear three pairs of pantyhose and just wrecks your whole day. And nothing was working right today. Steve was trying to pull audio into a movie file, and that wasn't working right. We're having trouble with something. Then Kyle's iPhone just like explodes on him. All of a sudden it says, I got attached to iTunes. I don't know what happened. And it goes to iTunes, and then it suddenly it ends up restoring the whole iPhone, and now his accelerometer's broken again. Went to Apple, and of course I couldn't get an appointment. None of that worked. And then I was working over in Google Groups, and it decided to change my font. And the whole purpose of the font I'd used was Courier New, so that it was all lined up perfectly, and it looked like a little table, but it was actually in a text document. Couldn't get that to work. It kept changing the font back to me. I swear, nothing worked right today. So I went out to wash my car, and I thought, man, maybe my car's going to catch on fire or something. I got really worried about it. But it's time to move on with the show, but I'm going to start with a crank. I would like to tell you why you should never buy anything from Newegg. You may recall several years ago when I had a fiasco with a series of Samsung monitors. I bought the original monitor through Newegg, who refused to help me when the monitor died 3 days after they shipped it to me. After 4 months of emails and phone calls up through executive support at Samsung, it cost me $50 worth of tax and shipping from Newegg to never get a working monitor from Samsung. I swore off Newegg, and I especially swore off Samsung as a company. Newegg, in particular, for the refusal to help me and the refusal to repay me the tax and shipping. And Samsung for an amazing bench strength of what Bart would call Muppets. Every single person I worked with told me things they do, which they didn't. Even at the very end, when they did send me the check, less $50 for the monitor I bought, they sent it to the wrong address, so it still took weeks to finally even get paid the lower amount that they'd agreed to. But why am I talking about Newegg again? Well, remember my excessively generous friend Namdar, who bought me that really cool FireWire disk enclosure called the Icy Dock? Well, unfortunately, the Icy Dock failed. That doesn't actually bug me that much. You know, stuff happens, right? It's all in how you're dealt with when things do go wrong. Well, when Nam gave it to me, he took back the box so he could do the mail-in rebate with the UPC barcode. Very cool. Well, now that it's failed, we look on the Newegg site and they say we've got a 3-year warranty through them. Hot dogs, no problem. All I gotta do is ship it back. I apply for an RMA number and they send it back. So I sent the IC doc back. And very carefully wrapped in bubble wrap and, you know, the whole thing. And guess what? They refuse it because I did not include the box, including the UPC barcode. That means if you buy anything through Newegg and exercise the rebate, you have voided your warranty with them. What kind of crapola is that? Excuse my French. They have now declared that we have to deal directly with the vendor. I knew I should have started with the vendor first. Probably will be a mess anyway. I now add Newegg to my very, very short list, actually, of do not buy computer places. Well, let's switch gears and have some fun with some software. You may remember from the demo episode that I was really excited and dismayed about a new product from Real Networks called Real DVD. I was dismayed because it was Windows only for now. I was excited because it looks like a really cool solution to the problem of how to get DVDs into your computer easily, organize them, as we take for granted today with music. As they demonstrated it, if you stick in a DVD, you get a window offering one of three choices: play the DVD, copy the DVD, or play and copy the DVD. Believe it or not, this software can copy the DVD while you're playing it real time, which was pretty impressive. The interface was gorgeous. It had all the album artwork, and you could search by genre, by rating, like PG versus R, and other tags that you could define. All your videos showed up in one nice, clean interface. You could even put all of the DVDs on an external drive. When you hook it up to the computer, they seamlessly end up in the Real DVD library. I was impressed by this interface and thrilled that someone had found a legal way to do what we all want to do. The reason it was legal was because they did not break the copy protection, because they simply create an image of the DVD containing the movie, the special features, and the copy protection. In fact, I think they add some copy protection onto that to make sure you don't share it with more machines than you paid for. After I described all of this on the demo episode, both Frank and Donald wrote in to me to let me know that there's a Mac equivalent to real DVD called Drive-In from the great people over at Telestream, who sell their products through Flip for Mac, which is probably the name you remember. On that device, I decided I must review Drive-In. But before I jump into that, though, there is big news on the real DVD front. On Tuesday, Hollywood decided to sue Real Networks for real DVD. Yep, they decided that Real is helping people steal movies. I really hate stuff like this. What morons! I'm really hoping that the courts rule in favor of Real on this one. It's a big test of the fair use law against the idiotic Digital Millennium Copyright Act. I'll be watching this one very carefully. Okay, back to the fun part. Let's talk about Drive-In. As usual, I didn't read any of the instructions. I just launched the program and dug in. It seemed pretty obvious that I should stick a DVD in first, and when I did, the opening window showed that I had stuck in Office Space. By the way, one of the best movies of all time. I saw a button that said Download Info, so I clicked it and Drive-In queried me for the barcode on the box. Would have been a little bit cooler if they just used my eyesight as a scanner. Maybe they'll do that as an enhancement someday. I think I'll ask them. Well, anyway, after I plugged in the barcode, all of the movie information was in Drive-In. Actors, producers, all that, reviews, pretty much everything Amazon knows about the movie. All except one thing. It did not pull in the cover art. That was kind of weird, so I tried a second movie, Best in Show, and it got the cover art just fine. No clue why Office Space didn't work, especially when all I had to do was go over to Amazon, pop up the cover art there, save it, and then paste it into Drive-In. I hope this doesn't happen on a lot of movies, because it was a little bit annoying, but I'd only tested a couple. I think I actually ended up doing three, and two out of three worked fine, so it's probably just some aberration. Well, once you've pulled in your movies, you can just open them from whatever folder you save them in. Drive-In mounts the disc image right on your desktop, and it looks like a regular DVD, and launches in the DVD player, just like a normal DVD, except way faster. Drive-In doesn't have any of the slick interface of real DVD that I described, where it's sort of like iTunes but for movies, but it does deliver on its promise in moving full DVDs to your hard drive so you can take them on the road with you. And it's significantly faster than the somewhat questionable legality methods of taking the copy protection off and re-encoding only to your hard drive. It took about a half hour to copy each of the two DVDs I tried, and on this machine, I think it's more like 2 hours for the unapproved method of copying. One unexpected pleasure, as I mentioned, was how fast you can start up a movie and flip through the scene selections with a Drive-In disc image. It was instantaneous to go from the main menus to the special features and hit the play button, and boom, it starts up instantly. Very cool feature. Another thing is, remember I said it's an exact copy? So you do get all of the features of the real DVD, and it's not compressed at all, so you get full quality on your movies, too. If you'd like to give Drive-In a try before you buy, you can get a demo version that will let you copy two DVDs so you can see how fun and easy it is. If you're sold, Drive-In is only $39 for a single-seat license or $59 for a multi-seat license, allowing you to play your movies on up to 5 computers. Go check it out at flipformac.com/drivein.htm. Well, I wrote up that part of the review, and then I realized how incredibly cool this could be. I was so enamored with Drive-In that I bought the 5-seat license. So picture this. I can now take a ton of our DVDs at only a half hour in time to encode them apiece, back them up to an external portable drive, and then whoever's going to travel just throws that little portable drive into their laptop bag, and they've got tons of choices of whatever DVD they want to watch, in full quality, with all the special features, for $59. That isn't awesome. I don't know what is. Well, listener Mark sent in an interesting story of his effort to get eSATA working on his Mac Pro. Let's have a listen.
Hello, Allison. This is Mark Anderson from Tucson, Arizona. I recently did a hardware upgrade to my 2.66 GHz Quad Xeon Mac Pro machine that I thought was interesting and wanted to share it with you and possibly your audience. This is my first audio review attempt, so I'd appreciate any comments you may have. Here's my problem statement. Last year, I purchased a CoolGear external quad interface drive enclosure. Initially, I was excited about the eSATA interface because the transfer speed was reported to be even faster than FireWire 800. I soon discovered, though, that my nearly new Mac Pro did not have an eSATA interface, and I was forced to settle for the FireWire 800 speed, which worked just fine for my super-duper backups. But, being the tinkerer that I am, I longed for the extra speed boost that eSATA promised, and while I did not have even the slightest practical need for the faster interface, I knew that I had to have it. Soon, I discovered that newer technology sold an eSATA extender cable for my model Mac Pro, and at a very reasonable cost of $25 plus shipping, I could operate my now not-so-new external hard drive at the maximum speed possible. I couldn't resist it. It was, on the surface, a relatively simple upgrade, but I soon discovered while reading the installation guide that it involved taking multiple components out of the Mac Pro's case, and since this would be my first foray into mucking about inside my precious, I was more than a little nervous doing it. In fact, I put off completing the project for over 8 months because of my perception about the complexity of the installation. I finally resolved to complete the project and push forward into the unknown. The newer tech eSATA extender cable does exactly what the title of the product implies. It extends the two logic board eSATA connectors located near the front of the Mac Pro's case to a more convenient location at the back of the case. The eSATA extender cable doesn't actually use the PCI Express slot on the logic board, but it uses one of the dead plate locations. I only had my stock video card installed, so it wasn't a big deal for me. The extension unit itself is a couple of flat red eSATA cables about 18 inches long attached to a nice cover plate. Very simple. The NewerTech installation guide is very clear, with large, well-captioned photos and cautionary statements about paying attention to static electricity and the proximity to sensitive components. The tool list consisted of only two Phillips screwdrivers, a P1 and P0 size. Additionally, depending on your Mac Pro's time of manufacture, you might need a thin pair of needle-nose pliers to hold a couple of improperly installed screw standoffs. Mine were apparently installed properly because I didn't need the pliers at all. The first step, of course, was taking off the side door, and that was accomplished without incident. Step two was removing the two memory riser cards from the memory bay. This allows the removal of four screws holding the memory bay to both the logic board and the computer case. Step three required the removal of all four of the hard drive trays from their bays, and that was easily accomplished. Step four is removing the PCI Express retaining plate so that the video card and one of the dead cover plates can be removed. This is where the two-port termination plate will be installed. NewerTech recommends using the topmost location, I assume to allow for additional PCI Express cards if you choose to install them. Step four required removing a small screw holding the large plastic fan enclosure to the logic board near the front of the case. Once this was loose, the memory bay housing needed to be slid to the right slightly, and the plastic processor cover removed. Step 5 was the most difficult part of the whole operation, removing the large plastic fan enclosure completely from the case. The fan enclosure has a power connector at the back that plugs directly into the logic board. Wiggling that loose was very nerve-wracking. I thought I was going to crack the case, but eventually it came out without breaking. After removing the fan assembly, the entire logic board was exposed for my viewing pleasure. The two SATA ports were very easy to locate and would not have been accessible without the disassembly in the previous steps. The next steps involved inserting two eSATA cable plugs, and then carefully routing the flat cable behind the four black rectangular plugs that the hard drives plug into at the top of the logic board. You then have to slide the eSATA plate into the previously opened slot in the PCI Express panel and double-check that the cables are truly out of the way of the hard drive trays. You reinstall the PCI Express retaining plate and begin installing the components you removed earlier in reverse order. I can say that the reinstallation was considerably easier than removal, and everything went back together without a hitch. I was very pleased to discover that on restart, my external drive appeared on the desktop right below my main boot drive icon, and it no longer had the typical external USB or FireWire icon. It appeared as though it were an internal drive, which I guess is the case now. I did have to redo my Super Duper clone backup, but it is now reliably mounting and can be used as a boot drive. I also noticed during the Super Duper copy that the effective copy speed approached 25 megabytes per second and never really dropped below about 12 megabytes per second. I'm quite pleased with that copy speed. A couple of operational notes, though. According to the installation manual, eSATA drives or components must be turned on before starting the computer, and the components are not hot swappable. All in all, this turned out to be an easy upgrade that I was glad to have done. My initial apprehension about doing this work inside my Mac Pro was unwarranted, and certainly similar to my forays into hardware manipulation in the Windows world. I think this upgrade adds value to my Mac Pro, and the speed bump was well worth the effort. I'd recommend this do-it-yourself project to anyone who is even remotely comfortable with computer hardware. Thanks, Allison, for your show and the opportunities to submit this installation review.
Well, Mark, it sounds like you're pretty courageous in the hardware department. I suppose for the hardcore geeks, doing all that kind of thing is really easy, but, I'll throw new software on at the drop of a hat, but my heart cringes when it comes to doing any hardware repairs or installations. That's why I call Pat Dengler for all my hardware needs. Well, thanks for sending in that great story.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, David Bogdan from Japan wrote in with a great story about Dumb Question Corner. It's not technically a dumb question. He says, funny thing happened when I was listening to your number 171 podcast. For the last month or so, I've been debating whether to pose a dumb question for you. I normally hate posting things, but I had this one on my mind for quite a while. Anyway, you had just finished the not very dumb question from Germany, and we're going into the next question when I made up my mind to finally ask the question. I opened up Disk Utility to make sure I had what I needed to ask the question. Lo and behold, as soon as I opened it, listener Pat asked the very question I was going to ask. Just goes to show you that what you say is true. Chances are someone else has the same question. Isn't that a great story? I just love that. And I'm betting Pat enjoyed that as well. Well, it's time for a word from our fabulous sponsor, ScreenSteps. It seems that every week I find out some new little nugget about ScreenSteps, what it can do that I didn't know about, and it becomes just that little bit more valuable. Unlike some products where you keep running into what it can't do, I keep finding out more that ScreenSteps can do. At the risk of making it sound like just the most awesome screen capture tool ever, remember, it's so much more than that. It's designed to create beautiful manuals or short instructions on how to do things on your Mac or Windows machine. This week, the nugget I learned, thanks to research assistant Niraj, is if you want to pull down one screenshot that you've annotated in ScreenSteps, you can. All you have to do is click on the little clipboard next to your beautifully annotated image, and it pulls the image into the clipboard. I know, duh. Why didn't I figure that out on my own? Well, hey, I didn't. But this is really useful if you want to show someone how to do something, and you just need one image to do it. But you want some nice annotation on it. Like, I don't think anybody else can do the sequence of steps the way ScreenSteps can. If you find yourself teaching other people how to use tools, head on over to the website and click on the big ScreenSteps logo on podfeet.com and download the trial and watch the video tutorials. They're really short and sweet, and they get you hooked. When you're ready to buy, don't forget to use the coupon code NOCILLA, all capital letters, and get 25% off the purchase price. You may remember that I reviewed a product called Cool Iris Previews a few years ago or so, and then I reviewed it again recently, and I got confused on the name because it was called Pick Lens, and then I got confused again because I think they called it Cool Iris. I still, to this day, do not know what product is what, but no matter what you do, you have to go check out the newly released version of Cool Iris, which, by the way, says formerly known as Pick Lens. Well, Cool Iris is a Firefox plugin that will change how you view photos on the internet. This is going to be impossible to do justice in audio, but I have to try. On the Cool Iris website at cooliris.com, they describe this as a transforming your browser into a full-screen 3D experience for photos and videos. So try to picture this. You click the Cool Iris icon in the upper right-hand corner of your Firefox window. Suddenly, the screen turns black, and thumbnails of gorgeous photos come up on screen. Okay, what's news about that? Cool Iris could do that before. But wait, there's more. At the bottom of the screen is a scroll bar, and when you grab that, that's when the excitement begins. The wall of photos really becomes 3D. It tilts at an angle and swooshes by, and then when you slow down your scrolling, the wall slowly tilts back until it's perpendicular to you again. It's a beautiful effect. Now, that's just on a random set of photos, and of course they're gorgeous ones. It gets better, believe it or not. At the top right, there's a search field. It has Google, Flickr, SmugMug, DeviantArt, PhotoBucket, and more. Especially with Flickr, since people put their very best photos up there, you can put in any search term and be treated to a 3D wall of beauty. That's enough, you say? I say no. In the upper left-hand corner, there's a Discover button that lets you simply view the latest photos in the news on topics from business, technology, world news, sports, Hollywood, all kinds of stuff. I checked out Cool Iris using the Discover Technology tab. I lost a half an hour looking at pictures. The worst part is that when you're on a picture from the Discover section, there's an arrow next to it that will take you to the news article that the photo is from. Okay, there went another half hour. I thought I was finally free of the seduction of Cool Iris, but then I noticed a little floating window in the bottom right of my screen, and it turns out it was a Return to Cool Iris button. It's a miracle I ever got this review done because I just kept playing with it. At the risk of never getting anything done after I tell you about this next part, I'll tell you about Cool Iris's last trick. When you find a photo that takes your breath away, there's a little envelope on the screen. Click that, and you can email the photo instantly to anyone's email address you can remember. Cool Iris is a most amazing tool. You simply must go get it. If you want to see for yourself, check out the video demos over at cooliris.com/demo. After I finished writing all of this up, listener Mark told me that he really likes close-up pictures of dragonflies. So you know what happened, right? Went over to Cool Iris, changed the search to Flickr, typed in dragonfly, and lost another half hour. There are some really cool pictures of dragonflies in Flickr. You got to go check it out. Oh, wait. Here's another reason to be in the live chat. Just now I got a little ping from Willie saying that Cool Iris also works in IE and Safari. So go check it out if you're on those browsers, too. Do you hate going to the auto mechanic to get maintenance on your car? Do you hate having to arrange rides and get to work late and have to leave work early just to get your car fixed? I bet you even put it off till it's way later than you should just because of how annoying that process is, don't you? Are you jealous of all us Honda and Acura owners who live in the LA and Orange County areas because we can have Honda Bob just drive to our houses and take care of us? Well, if you're one of the very few people left in the entire LA and Orange County area who have not called Honda Bob yet, what are you waiting for? Give him a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email over at hdabob@aol.com. HA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. It's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie, except BartB.ie is not on the air.
It's getting closer again. As always seems to happen, I say, you know, anything with computers, it'll take a few days. No, it won't. It'll take a week or a little more. Nothing in computers ever takes as short as you think. You know, I've learned that lesson. I think, honey, I'm going to be 5 minutes changing out this hard drive. You know, 4 hours later, no, I don't want food yet. I'm still changing out that hard drive.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing I notice is the really new people to computers think that it's a science. They think if it's all ones and zeros that the outcome is predictable.
Yeah, no.
I think we may have
talked
about that
before. People are still
involved. Yeah, and I think the farther you get into computing, the more you realize that a significant portion is black magic.
But, yeah, well, I'm not sure black magic is necessarily the word, but the thing is, you know, computers are quite infiltrated by human foibles, because it was old program. You know, the computer may be perfectly logical, but if its instructions are illogical, the outcome is illogical.
Yeah, that's true. But it does seem that there's a, well, okay, at the least you'll give me chaos theory, right? Too many variables for the outcome to always be known.
Well, no, I think your computer blindly does exactly what it's told by silly people.
Well, that's a, we can have that discussion later. That's not on the agenda, because what's on the agenda today is how Bart's wrong.
Yes, well, what show isn't right? It doesn't start with how Bart is wrong.
At least if I'm driving. All right, so I got several letters from people saying that GoDaddy bugged the daylights out of them to renew. Unlike where you said that they are, you know, sitting waiting at the edge of their chairs to sell your domain out from under you. My favorite response, though, was from Zeke, and here's what he said. By the way, Bart is like my hero, but I have to say he was wrong about GoDaddy. I had a domain that I didn't want to renew. I had to go to manual to set it to not renew. They sent me a ton of emails, and I believe even a 3-day extension past the date. I'll see if I can find the email. But I am off GoDaddy for hosting because I needed SSH, SFTP, terminal access, and a bunch of other stuff. I moved to Media Temple, and I'm loving the flexibility. It's a web geek's dream come true. Their interfaces are beautiful. So you're wrong, but you were sort of right.
Yeah, well, I think it obviously depends on how valuable your domain is. Or the guy who was on Floss Weekly was just flat out lying. But he sounded like a nice guy. And you don't lie to Leo, do you?
Like, no, I don't.
How could you lie to Leo?
You can't.
Well, does that I guess experiences vary, I guess, is the lesson there.
Yeah, definitely. I don't doubt that it did happen, but anyway, just wanted to point that out to you that I got a whole lot of letters about that.
Well, no, it's good, and it's good for people to hear all sides of any story anyway. People are going out making these decisions, so they should hear from everyone.
Right, right. Hey, so back on, actually on last week's show, I wanted to ask you some further questions. I was very embarrassed this morning when Steve and I were re-listening to Chit Chat Across the Pond from last week, and he asked me, he said, what is a virtual dedicated host? And I hope no one that I work with is hearing me ask this question, but I realized I did not know the difference between virtual dedicated and shared hosting. That sounds like the same thing to me, and I thought maybe you could go through the three different types and just kind of some clear, concise differences between the three for me and maybe for somebody else.
Okay. Well, we'll start with the shared, because that's the oldest model that's been around for a long time. Your Mac could run a shared hosting company if you wanted. Your Mac has an FTP service, and your Mac has web sharing, which is actually Apache under the hood. So shared web hosting is literally like you taking your Mac, putting it on the internet, and then giving people accounts. And so you give 10 people accounts, those 10 people are sharing your Mac. Does that make...
Okay, make so they've got favorite? It's got one operating system installation, but several... So could you have a bunch of separate WordPress installations all running on my Mac at the same time?
Yeah, of course could.
Okay.
But they're all on the one operating system, they're all using the one instance of Apache, and they're all using the one instance of MySQL.
So if you wanted, a more recent version of MySQL or Apache or PHP or something like that, you couldn't have it because everybody has to go together?
To a very large extent. Now, you can do some tricks, as GoDaddy are doing, with the different versions of PHP, because Apache is actually very smart. Web server. So you can set an Apache configuration per folder. So you can actually have a completely different configuration on two different folders within your home folder even.
Wow.
And so in one folder, PHP 5 could be in use, and another folder, PHP 4 could be in use.
Okay. All right.
Which is pretty sweet.
Yeah.
But you are still sharing, it's one machine, it's one operating system, it's one Apache instance. So if something happens to that machine, either it gets DDoSed or... the fact that it's all the one web server is a little worrying because it means it's the one user. So if someone compromises Apache in some way, then they have access to all of your stuff because it's the one Apache user serving out everyone's stuff.
And for everybody else listening, DDoS is denial of, dedicated, or wait, distributed denial of service attack. So that's where, you know, somebody's getting too many hits just to wreck something. Okay, so that's shared. Then virtual dedicated is next, or dedicated is next?
No, we'll go to dedicated, because virtual dedicated is a recent compromise.
Okay.
So in the past, your only other option was to, you know, take one physical machine per customer is dedicated hosting. So that one customer has the entire machine completely to themselves. It's still running one instance of Apache, but it doesn't matter because it's all yours.
So you've got the CPU completely dedicated to you as fast as it is.
Yeah.
It's always, and you get and the NIC card is all yours. You're not sharing that network bandwidth with anybody. You got the whole thing.
Yeah. The OS is yours to configure as you wish. The web server is yours to configure as you wish. The RAM is all yours to use as you wish. The CPU is all yours to hammer to your heart's content. Like you say, the network is all yours to fill up as much as you want. It's just you. So
you
no one
break,
else comes into the equation.
You could break it too, huh?
Oh, absolutely. You can break anything. Nothing is unbreakable. But it's just you. So you're not... You have way more resources for a start. But also, you have complete control over those resources. You can do anything you like. So it's like having your Mac on the internet and not letting anyone else in.
Okay. I got you.
And then virtual dedicated is your halfway house, where you take a giant, big, huge machine. You install something like VMware on it, and then you give every user an instance of VMware, so they get a virtual machine. So in many ways, it's just like a dedicated machine, because there's one operating system in that virtual machine, which those users have complete control over. But you don't really have all of the CPU to yourself, because you're sharing the machine with a whole bunch of other people who each think they have their own operating system.
And you're sharing RAM and the NIC card and all of that.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Okay, that actually makes sense. I was having trouble in my head figuring out how the shared thing worked. I understood virtual dedicated, but I didn't know shared was actually sharing the same OS.
You're on the same OS, and it's just separate accounts within the one OS.
Now, I would expect the GoDaddies of the world to be a little more flexible in what they'd allow you to do when you had virtual dedicated, because you're only going to hork yourself up.
Not entirely sure I follow.
Well, if I'm on virtual dedicated and I wanted SSH access, for example, they're probably more likely to let me have it there than they would on shared.
Well, not only more likely, they will, because you control the operating system. So if you want SSH access, you just turn it on.
Ah, okay. Okay. Now, again, the price difference is pretty big. It's I think last week we were talking about like $3 a month versus $27 a month going from shared to virtual dedicated.
Yeah, and then jumping up to about $60 for the cheapest actual dedicated. And with actual dedicated, there is no limit. Like, if you want, you know, 5 redundant RAID arrays or something, someone will sell it to you. And they'll charge you, like, you know, $5,000 a month for it or something. But whatever you want, I mean, I'm pretty sure if you went out there and bought a Cray supercomputer, someone would put it in a hosting place for you and charge you for it per month. I mean, you know, whatever amount of money you want to be parted with, someone will take it off you for really fancy dedicated hosting.
Right. Okay, well, I think that winds that up. I just wanted to understand those three, and I think you cleared it up for me anyway.
Oh,
so
goody.
We have and I won't say you're wrong about any of that.
Well, that's the listener's job.
That's right, that's right. They have their duties as well. So what's our next subject here?
Well, I just wanted to go through two little lessons I learned this week, or relearned, or I think I probably learned these before, but anyway. It's just, I've been having a slow time of it, because what I thought would take me a few days has clearly taken me a week and counting. So I just came across two things, and the first is something that's been annoying me for a while. If you want to see this for yourself, there's a very simple way to have it happen to you. Buy a domain that doesn't end in .com, but where the .com version is not registered. So I run a little company called Bartificer Web Solutions that I do hosting for people and stuff. And I've always been on .net, because I don't like .com. It's just a thing I have. But the .com has been available for years. And every now and then you get this email saying, you know, the virtual, you know, quick now, strike while the iron is hot. You know, your .com domain is now available for only, you know, reserve it now for only $300. And, of course, if you look and go to register it yourself, you'll find it's registered because... I have to be careful how I word this for legal reasons. But basically, certain individuals of ill repute, what they do is they go around and they buy up domains that they think people will definitely want. They pick them up for the standard GoDaddy cheap price, and then they try to flog them off to you. They basically hold you to ransom, domain squatting effectively. and then they'll charge as much as they think they can get away with. So if it's a particularly good domain, they'll charge you, you know, many thousands. But in this case, it was only, my domain was only worth 300. But actually, they're very, very smart, these individuals, because they don't actually spend a cent. They get the domains on a 5-day money-back guarantee thing. So they might buy 500 domains for 5 days, send out all of those emails. If anyone bites, you know, they pay the $9 or whatever to get that domain for the year, and then they sell it on for their $300. And if you don't bite, they just release the domain after 5 days on the money-back guarantee jobby.
Oh.
So if that happens to you, wait. No matter how much you want the domain, just wait. Sit it out.
So give it 5 days.
Because the chances are, give it a week or two, give it a bit of time, and the chances are the domain will come free again. Hmm. Now, if it's a really, really, really valuable domain, it won't come free again. The squatters will keep on it until you give in. But if it's just a regular enough domain, it'll come free again. And as evidence, I now own bartificer.com
$0.99. And they offered it to you for the bargain price of 300, huh?
They offered me for the bargain price of 300 and made it sound like it was a phantasmagorical deal. And that they were doing me a favor to protect me from having other people take my domain. I mean, the emails you get are fantastically well worded. And if you didn't know what you were at, you would very easily fall for it and think that, oh my God, you know, someone here is saving me from those nasty domain squatters while defrauding you of $300.
Wow, that's fantastic. What a great little lesson.
I'm happy to have that domain.
And I understood the whole thing.
And there was you. Yeah, so you didn't understand it when I wrote it down, but obviously I can't write.
All right, cool.
Then
what
the
else?
Other thing is some DNS stuff. We didn't really look into DNS in detail last time. We just said that you need someone to hold your DNS for you. But you don't just need someone to hold it for you.
Back up and define what DNS is real quickly.
Okay, so the DNS is the domain name service. So when you type into your web browser, www.bartb.ie, the DNS translates that nice name that you can remember into an IP address, which is where my server is actually at.
Okay.
And so if that translation doesn't happen, no one gets to your web page, because no one's going to remember your IP address.
Okay.
So DNS, basically, DNS is a very old system, but it consists of a bunch of records, and those records basically define a whole bunch of stuff about your domain. And, you know, if we have a bit of time, I was thinking we might actually talk about the different types of DNS record a little later. But the main point is that you really do want control over these records, because if you don't have control over them, you can't manipulate them. So you need some sort of domain control panel. If you have shared hosting, this isn't as important, because on shared hosting, the default setup is generally correct. So you'd let whoever you were buying your shared hosting from set up your domain for you, and then you wouldn't worry about editing the records yourself, because they will have set up the records to point at your shared hosting.
Right. Why would I ever want to mess with those?
Well, as soon as you go the dedicated route, you are going to want to mess with them. You're going to want to control your subdomains and so forth. And if you don't have a control panel to do it, then you have a problem.
So I'm kind of confused. So I own podfeet.com. Why would I ever want to change what podfeet.com pointed to?
Well, if you had your own dedicated server, you'd need to make sure it pointed at that for a start.
Okay. But once that's done, what else would I need to do?
You might also want to point your email somewhere else, because the chances are you don't want to run your own you don't want to run a mail server on your web server, so you might buy email service from someone else, which is what I do, because mail servers are really hard to configure. If you make even the slightest mistake, you end up being spam central for half the planet. So I don't do it. They're a fairly specialist server, a mail server,
right.
So easy to get wrong. So I don't waste my time running a mail server. I buy one for $40 a year. But that means I have to point the email from my domain at a different mail server to where the web stuff goes. That involves manipulating your DNS. Then I really, really, really hate having the SSH login on the same IP address as my web server, because every script kiddie in the planet tries to hack people's servers by looking at the same IP address that their www is on, and then trying to attack port 22 and port 21 and a couple of other standard ports. So I use a separate IP address on the same physical server for SSHing to, but I like to give it a name as well. I'm not going to say what that name is. because I do like to keep that secret. But then I need to set up a DNS record for that. And then maybe I want to host some other stuff. Maybe I want to put a subdomain to do something else, and that subdomain might reside in a different server. I've done that for quite a few different things. That's another DNS record. And if you've no way to control these DNS records, you really don't control your domain. You own it, but you don't have any real power to manipulate it. Hmm. So some hosting companies give you a full domain control panel with hosting. Some domain registrars give you a full domain control panel with domain registration. But you can end up in the unfortunate situation where your name, the person you registered the name with, is not one of the people who give you a control panel, and the person you get your hosting with is not one of the people who get your control panel. And that's where I found myself this week.
Okay, I think I'm still following.
It's basically you want a control panel. Some hosting providers do, some hosting providers don't. Some name registrars do, some name registrars don't. If you get the wrong combination, you end up with no control panel.
Ah, without a control panel, you can't do anything?
Without a control panel, you end up basically having to send emails to tech support of your registrar every time you need to change something. Yeah. So my DNS is hosted, but I don't have a control panel. So I now have to send in a tech support ticket every time I want it changed.
But how often does that happen? I mean, once you set up those things you just described, you know, where your mail is going and maybe your SSH, aren't you done? I mean, it's not like you need to do
You're
that daily
done.
Or anything.
Except that if I had a control panel, I would have been back up on the air ages ago. But right now, I'm waiting on a bunch of tickets to get dealt with for DNS changes. So it slowed me down by at least 2 days, if not more. And the next time I want to change anything, it's going to slow me down again.
Hmm. So what's the advice? What should people do to avoid that?
Ask the question beforehand. Do you have a domain control panel? And make sure that at least one of the parts in your jigsaw has one. And then you'll be fine.
Okay.
So, do we want to talk a little about DNS records or not?
Yeah, it looks like we have a few more minutes here.
Okay. So, I said, without really explaining, that DNS controls email, and I left it at that. Okay, DNS clearly also controls where web browsers go to, and it does a few other things. So, the way it does it is by having different types of records. So the most basic record is called an A record. And an A record says that this IP address goes, sorry, this name matches this IP address.
Okay, that's the part I understand, right there.
Yeah, so you have a DNS A record that says that podfeet.com goes to your shared hosting.
Right.
You have a second DNS A record that says that www.podfeet.com goes to your shared hosting.
Oh, I remember. We set those up separately so that people didn't have to type that www. And I'm always appalled when I find big companies where you have to type www.
Yeah.
I say, come on.
Yeah. Yeah, they're missing an A record.
Okay.
And what you can also do, which I'm not sure we did for you, you can also set up a wildcard A record called star.
Hmm.
And so you could probably, if your A records are set up as such, you could probably type in anything.podfeet.com and end up at your website.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. So the star is a valid A record as well.
Okay.
So they're A records. And they're sort of the main thrust of your domain. Then the other important types of records are called MX records, which stands for Mail Exchanger Records.
Okay.
And when you type an email address into your mail client and hit send, your mail client takes the bit after the at sign and does a DNS lookup on it and asks the relevant DNS server, where do I send the email for this domain? And the DNS server responds with its MX record.
So again, it's like if they're trying to write to Allison@podfeet.com, the yep. MX record is what tells it where podfeet.com yep. is in mail land?
Land.
Okay.
Yeah. And you're on a shared hosting, but you also get an email server from GoDaddy. The chances are that's not the same physical machine.
Oh.
In fact, not only the chances are, but it's almost certainly not. So you have an MX record too, and that MX record sends your email off to GoDaddy's email server from where you can pop it or IMAP it or whatever you do.
Okay, and in your case, you've actively made that mail server be something different too.
Exactly. So I've actively controlled my A record to my dedicated server and actively controlled my MX record to a different mail server.
Okay.
Then the last, there's two more types of record. An important one that's used a lot is an alias. And an alias just basically does what it says in the tin. It's like a shortcut on your desktop or whatever. You can set up an alias that says that...
ooh, I know one. NoSilicast.com. which doesn't actually exist, but it points over to podfeed.com.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
An alias, right?
So you can set up a DNS record which says that I'm not really a DNS record. Just make me point at whatever that one points at.
Right.
So I can set up a record for, I don't know, I can set up a record for subdomain 1.bartbouchats.ie and say that that actually just means www. So you just basically map one name to another name.
Right, right.
And then that name is looked up to get an IP address.
That example I gave is true. If somebody types in nocellacast.com right now, they'll go to podfeet.com because I figured there's going to be people who don't want to remember two names.
Okay, so then you have a DNS alias that says podfeet.com is really that, and then you go and then your DNS, your web browser actually goes up and looks up the other IP address. Okay, I want podfeet.whatever that doesn't exist. DNS says, actually, you want this. And it goes, okay, give me the IP address for that. And it goes, oh, there it is.
Cool.
So it's just a little link in the chain. It's an alias, a redirect, a pointer, whatever. And then the last type, which is a type that is set by your registrar, is what's called an NS record. And the NS record actually says what name server is responsible for that domain.
You would define
that
specifically?
Yep. So when you're actually registering a domain, what you're actually doing is getting the people who own the top-level domain to give you NS records. So when you register podfeet.com...
Wait, back up. Say one more time, what is an NS record?
It tells you the name server or the DNS server that's responsible for a domain. That's the boss of that domain. DNS server is cache, but there's one record that's authoritative.
Okay.
That's the ultimate answer.
So why do I need to know that?
Well, when you're registering a domain, what you're actually doing is setting the name server record, or you're buying the right to determine the name server record for your domain.
Okay.
So when you registered podfeet.com, what GoDaddy did for you, apart from take your money off you, is they contacted the people who run .com, and they told them to insert into the .com name servers an NS record that says that podfeet.com is to be given to this DNS server, which is GoDaddy's DNS server, and that it has all the right answers for Podfeet, and it is to be taken as the authority on the matter.
Okay.
And so that's it. That's all there is to DNS.
That's interesting. Really. Yeah. It's kind of seeing the stuff under the hood of the car, what's actually making it go. It does show you a lot of the complexity, too, though, of... You know, a human is in there typing something at that point. The chances of that getting boogered up, you know, it's kind of amazing this stuff actually works as often as it does.
You could say that. And I've had lots of DNS problems get boogered up where they put in the wrong, you know, typo in the IP address for the A record and suddenly your domain vanishes.
You know, this
The reason I wanted to mention it is because in a lot of hosting control panels, you will see things like MX record and A record.
Okay. So if people are running into that going, what's that?
Yeah, exactly. So I figured it might be nice to explain what an A record is, and what the two important ones are A records and MX records.
Right, right.
And there's a nice little terminal command you can use to actually see what the story is. If you type dig and then space a domain name, it'll go and show you the A records and the NS records.
You mean just in my terminal here? If I
in your terminal
in dig bartb.ie?
Yeah, so yeah.
Interesting. As he goes away and types.
Yeah, so you should get back an answer section. Okay, this isn't playing nice. Maybe it was host. Sorry. There's loads of commands for looking up DNS. Yeah, that's it. No, it isn't. Yes, there's no comma in bartb.ie. There is, in fact, a dot. So if you type host and then bartb.ie, you'll see two records come up. It'll say that it'll show the A record, but it won't say it's an A record. And then it'll show separately that mail is handled by and give you a different answer. So that's an A record and an MX record.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Your mail is at rack365.com.
My mail was at rack365.com.
So it hasn't propagated
yet
right
because
now?
I had to lodge a ticket and the ticket hasn't been dealt with. And then when the ticket's dealt with, then the DNS has to propagate. So it's going to probably put me back another day or two.
All right. So you're saying you don't get instant response from your ISP there, unlike GoDaddy, who writes back to me immediately?
Well, no, the live chat is fantastic, but anything that involves the actual hardcore techies doing something involves you opening a ticket.
Oh, okay, it's the do part.
Yeah, but no, actually, the live chat is really good. You're never waiting for more than 20 seconds or so, and then you have someone, and they tell you... I mean, they can do a lot of stuff in the live chat, but once it gets to the point where they need to get a sysadmin involved, they log a call, and then it goes through the call tracking system.
Well, that makes sense.
It does make sense. It's still annoying, though. I wish I had a control panel. Then I could just do it myself and hit go.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine you not having control, right?
Yeah, me not having control makes me grumpy, to be honest.
All right. Well, this has been pretty interesting. I thought that DNS would be a lot drier than it actually is. That was a good way to learn from you.
Fascinating protocol. Because the way all the caching and stuff works is even more cool. And the you know, it's strange that it takes a few days for an answer to get around. But because of that strangeness, it's almost impossible to, you know, if you blow up one server, your domain doesn't vanish. You have like a wee bit of time to put it back. Because it was all, you know, it all comes from military origins. So it's a distributed database.
Oh, okay. Well, I like that one of the things I always tell people when they ask me for help and they're kind of amazed that I help them a lot is that none of us got here on our own. And it's your knowledge in this area is how come podfeet.com even exists on a viable server today. Because when you helped me move it over and set all these A records up and stuff, and I'm just going, okay, I'll just type whatever he says, you know, and I didn't understand any of it then. But, you know, each day I learn a little bit more.
Yeah, it's moving. Moving server is only difficult because DNS is a bit of a pain at times. If DNS were a little different, it would be easier to move, but easier to kill. And, you know, the fact that it's hard to move and hard to kill is probably not bad.
I would vote for that. Well, I think that's probably going to wind it up for this week. I enjoyed learning a lot this time.
Okay, glad to help.
Well, I know what you're all thinking. You're all thinking, where was Bart's until next time happy computing? Well, it turns out right at that instant, right before he got a chance to say goodbye, his Mac decided to do some automatic downloads. Turns out we both had a little discovery tour on how the automatic downloads work, and his was set up, as is mine, to just do it whenever it feels like it. So that might be a lesson to those of you making recordings like we do that you want to keep an eye on that. So basically, it sucked up 100% of his bandwidth, and that Skype thing just turned off like a switch. But he did call me later to tell me that he wanted to make sure he does wish you all happy computing until next time. Well, I got a couple of shows to pimp here. You guys really need to head on over and check out the Mac Roundtable podcast. We are having so much fun over there. It's a great show. I love listening to it when I'm not on, even though it frustrates me because I want to talk to them. And it's kind of harder because they're my friends. And, you know, I wish I could go, no, that's wrong or that's right. Oh, yeah, me too. Have a lot of fun over there. But luckily, this week I had even more fun. I was able to be on the International Mac Podcast. Go check that out at impodcast.tv. Those guys do a great job. It's quite a full crew and all kinds of strange accents in there. I mean, from Texas to British to Irish. I mean, it's crazy. Truly is international. Well, I'm afraid it's time we got to wrap up the show, but I got to make sure you know all the different ways to participate in the show. First of all, of course, you're already listening, so you got that one down. You want to go over to ustream.tv and check out the live show over at, it's at around 5 p.m. GMT-8, if you can figure out what the heck time that is. We have a lot of fun in there, and they goof around, and they talk about the strangest things when I'm not paying attention. So go check that out. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. And don't forget to listen to Podcasting on Podcasting. I actually did another episode. I'm so excited. Podcasting on Podcasting episode 11 is either going to be out right before this or right after this. Probably do both of them tonight. So if that isn't enough ways to get a hold of me, I need some more dumb questions. Didn't get any really good dumb ones this week. Actually, I had kind of a complicated one that I may talk about next week. But do send in your dumb questions, send in suggestions, send in complaints. I do get complaints from time to time, and every once in a while I try to take some of that into account. But do give me a shout-out over at nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.